So would you give me some numbers? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Okay, you'll have to speak up just a little. Good morning, Dr. Aronson. This is January 24th, 1977, and we're sitting in your office talking about many things, and we'll continue our conversation. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Florence.
The last time we met, we finished up by talking about the Miriam Hospital and your thoughts on the Miriam Hospital. I'd like to ask you this. In your career, you have worn and still do wear many hats. You're a scholar, physician, a writer, historian, a teacher. I could go on and on. What hat do you enjoy the most?
My pause is because I'm smiling in the direction of my wife, because she knows immediately the answer. Something that I've only rarely undertaken in my life, on usually 1 month a year for about 17 years in the 1950s and 60s, and early 70s also, where I would do general practice and on a kind of locum tenens basis, largely at children's camps in Maine and New Hampshire. These, in retrospect, were the times of greatest joy professionally for me. The non-professional aspect of my life clearly is my family. That's the source of my greatest joy. Three daughters and a wife who sustain me, keep me alive, occasionally keep me young, and my life's companion, who is sitting to my right now. But your question, I suspect, was only in the realm of professional activity. Then the answer would be doing general practice.
When you had patients, so that you were in private practice at one time?
At one time, yes. 1 month a year for almost 20 years.
And you did this once, just for 1 month during the course of the year? That's why didn't you do it more then, if you enjoyed it so much?
My profession in the 50s and 60s was as director of a very large academic center, laboratory, and department, and was mainly in the realm of research work in brain disease. And that took a good 11 months a year of activity, through federal grants, through interventions with patients, etc. So that's a different kind of professional life than the ad hoc problems which one encounters, and the social as well as the biological problems which one confronts when a patient comes into your office.
What do you think is the most important quality for a doctor in private practice?
I think that's like asking which is the most important leg in a stool. The stool will not defy gravity if it has only one leg or even two. A physician must be qualified in his or her intellectual attainments, in the commitment to discipline study. But if he were that only, then he'd be a technician, or she would be a technician, or an engineer rather than a physician. And a physician, therefore, has to be a scholar who is also committed to the interests of his patients and humane enough to understand the limits of his own skills and the underlying force and genius within the patient himself. that the patient must be enlisted in the healing process. If the patient is passive, the healing is going to be either slowed or aborted. So that there are many, many qualities that make for a good physician. Flexibility on the one hand and inflexibility on the other hand. Inflexibility in terms of his sense of commitment, that the patient is more important than the institution which hires the physician, more important than the insurance company, more important than anything else in terms of that particular physician.
Dr. Aronson, 22 years ago, to be exact, on February 28, 1975, you spoke at Temple Beth-El on a Friday night about the moral dilemmas in the field of medicine. And just a few weeks ago, on January 3rd, 1997, you spoke again. How have things changed since then?
Well, I'm 22 years older. And it took Temple Beth-El 22 years to show a tolerance so that they would listen again to a few words from me. Things have changed in my profession dramatically. We're far better able to cure nowadays. We're getting to a greater proportion of the population than we did 22 years ago. That's the good part. The bad part is that there is a remorseless industrialization of medicine that may very well be irreversible, and I find very frightening. The original sense of covenant between the patient and the physician, it was a one-to-one relationship. It embraced a lot of things, commitment, fee for service when fees were available. And nowadays there's a third party intervening in this one-to-one relationship, and these are insurance companies. And they've reached a stage where not only do they pay for the fee, not only do they pay for the services, but they determine the extent of the services, and they have now reached the stage where they are hiring the physicians. One of my civic responsibilities, I guess you'd call it, is to be chairman of the licensure board of the state of Rhode Island. And once a month, I interview all physicians seeking license in the state of Rhode Island. 30 years ago, the great majority of physicians coming into Rhode Island entered with the understanding that they would engage in private practice. They would share an office, rent an office, but they determined the dimensions of their practice, and then they left to chance whether or not they would have patients. And some of them succeeded, a few did not, and they left the state, or left medicine. But it was literally a private sector relationship. Nowadays, most physicians coming into the state come in on the basis of a salary. They sign a contract with an insurance company, a health maintenance organization, occasionally a university. But rarely, very rarely, do we now see physicians entering the state for the sole purpose of beginning a private practice. It is almost unheard of. And I find this kind of sad. It means that physicians will become corporations, that their loyalty, their allegiance is to a corporation rather than an individual patient. They work from 9 to 5, or 8 to 4, or 8 to 8, but whatever it is, they're told when to work. Their incomes are more than adequate, and an awful lot of my younger colleagues find this a very wonderful thing. When I grew up in medicine, most of my colleagues struggled. Some of them succeeded, some of them didn't. But salaries were not a question, except for those in research and those who were teaching. Obviously, if you're teaching, you're not going to expect a fee for service from each student. You leave an intermediate to take care of that, something called a college or a university. So I find this sad, and I find that what is called the industrialization of medicine is a very, very great threat to what medicine used to be.
We saw an example of what you're talking about. As a matter of fact, there was an article in this morning's newspaper about Lifespan in Rhode Island buying the New England
Medical Center.
Yeah. Would you call that an example of what you're talking about?
Indirectly, yes. There was, I felt, great virtue in community hospitals, hospitals that felt part of a particular geographic or ethnic community. The Miriam, for example, in its earlier days, was, while it proclaimed itself to be a general hospital, it was also, in addition, it was a hospital to the Jewish community. It gathered funds from the Jewish community in terms of charitable donations. It serviced the leadership as well as the rank and file of the Jewish community. It allowed a place for Jewish physicians who did not have access to inpatient care elsewhere in the state at that time in the 1920s. It allowed them a place to bring their patients. So the Miriam fulfilled an enormous role. It was an elegant hospital, particularly in the 1960s when the new building was built. It had some of the finest physicians in the state practicing there. The Miriam today is part of a large enterprise. Its individuality, and therefore its individual responsibility, is diminished. It's an elegant hospital. But that sense of pride, that sense of ethnic identity, that sense of having roots in a community, maybe 3 or 4 miles around the epicenter of Summit Avenue, is, I think, lost. Lifespan has absorbed far more than the Miriam Hospital and the Rhode Island Hospital. There's the Bradley Hospital, St. Joseph Hospital, Newport Hospital, shortly South County Hospital, the VNA of Rhode Island, and the organization that I'm very closely attached to and was formerly president of, Hospice Care of Rhode Island. So all of these organizations have joined and in the process have lost some individual flavor, something that made them Hamish, something that gave them individuality and identity. And you knew, for example, at the Miriam Hospital, 25 years. The specific question was, what will the effects of the absorption of the New England Medical Center into Lifespan mean? Locally as well as in Boston. In Boston, it's apt to mean that a medical school which has been in trouble, namely Tufts University School of Medicine, which has always used New England Medical Center as its teaching resource, now its future may be really in jeopardy. What will it mean locally? I don't have the foggiest notion, but I don't like it. Hospitals are not Walmart. Hospitals are not corporations to be bought and sold and spun off in mergers and acquisitions and consolidations and...
This is what seems to be happening now,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, and I'm afraid that in the interests of of a financial bottom line that the intangible qualities that a hospital provides for a community are going to be lost. A sense of community, a sense of identity. I fear for the future.
Now, you talked about the Miriam Hospital losing its ethnic identity. In the Jewish community, in the last few years, there was the closing of the Jewish Home, which I'm sure you were very familiar with. What did actually cause the closing of the Home? There are many people in the Jewish community that were, needless to say, disturbed about the closing, because the Home was such an important member of the Jewish community of Rhode Island.
Well, those who were disturbed typically were those who did not bother to inquire as to the realities. The realities 4 years ago were that the Home was structurally archaic and was no longer appealing to the Jewish community. Elderly Jews, either by themselves or by virtue of decisions made by their children, were no longer going to the Jewish Home. They were going to secular nursing homes, which were more flexible and could offer many more services than did the Jewish Home. And the Jewish Home, by 1993, was losing in excess of $60,000 a month. The Jewish community was approached about this with the need to rebuild the Home completely at a cost minimally in excess of $10 million. To choose a new site, indeed we had had new sites in mind. In private conversations with the leadership of the Jewish community, we were made to understand that that money would not be forthcoming, that there were other needs in the Jewish community that took a greater priority, all of them legitimate. Many of those needs were outside of the Providence area, indeed outside of the Rhode Island area, and a good 50% of it outside of the boundaries of the United States, namely the need to provide support in Israel, and the need at that time to support the transplantation of displaced Soviet Union Jews to this community. All of them being legitimate and certainly laudable goals.
And given priority to the Home?
At that time, the priority to the Home was somewhat in the Jewish community, not in the leadership of the Jewish Home Corporation, but in the Jewish community amongst our leaders, the priority was lower. We argued that point. We had still another burden on our backs, and that was the fact that the employees of the Home were unionized. And they threatened a strike unless...
We were talking about the Home.
Yeah. We had a rather hostile group of employees. The Home required large numbers of employees, as you possibly know. We had at that time about 365 beds, 370 beds, and an employee staff of well over 400. They were unionized, and the union felt that they were going to use us as a launching pad to unionize the entire state, at least the nursing homes of the state, and possibly the hospitals as well. That had two consequences. Consequence, and I'm talking now in brutal candor, consequence number one, because of our confrontations with the union, and they had struck the home on two prior occasions, you may remember, years before in the 1980s. But as a consequence of that, most hospitals in the community stayed far away from us for fear that if there were any kind of contractual liaison between the home and, for example, the Miriam Hospital, that by virtue of labor laws, the federal labor laws, that would permit active unionization of Miriam Hospital employees, something that did not exist at that time. And the trustees of the Miriam were very afraid that this would open the doors to something that would create, in their judgment, chaos at the Miriam. Secondly, it created in the minds of the relatives of the residents. We didn't call them patients at the Jewish home, they were residents. But the relatives coming in frequently each day saw with their own eyes what appeared to be a hostile group of nursing aides, nurses, etc. And it created a sense that the home was inappropriate for their relatives. And as a result, many of their relatives were taken out of the home and transferred to private homes. And we began having, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, many, many empty beds. We began filling them with people who were desperately seeking nursing care for the elderly, but who were not Jewish. And the stage was reached finally some 4 years ago when a good 10% of the beds, or the rooms, however you wish to enumerate it, were occupied by people who are not Jewish. So in conjunction with all of these things, an archaic plant that the community was not prepared to either rehabilitate or rebuild or replace, a hostile workforce.
What determined, or who determined the fact that the community wasn't ready to replace?
Those who were in the leadership of the home.
That would be the Jewish Federation?
No.
Oh, the home itself.
The home had its own corporation.
I see.
And it had leaders who were also, or some of whom, were also leaders in the Jewish Federation, and who approached the large donors to the Federation to seek out an informal understanding. Can we go ahead with a capital campaign drive? And we were, well, the corporation was told, the Jewish Home Corporation was told, this is an inappropriate time because it would conflict with other capital drives in the Jewish community. The Jewish community, you must realize, is very small. At best, it has 16,000 people. The most optimistic survey undertaken by Professor Goldstein of Brown University was that it was 16,000. Another survey that some of my colleagues and I undertook in behalf of the Jewish Home came up with the number of 13,800. So let's say we compromise, let's say it's 14,000 to 15,000. That is only a fraction more than 1% of the total population of Rhode Island, which is approximately 1 million people. That is a very inadequate base for the optimistic accomplishments that the Jewish community wishes to undertake to support a hospital, to support a nursing home, a large one, one of the largest in New England, to support a Bureau of Jewish Education, to support the Jewish Community Center, to support the Jewish Family Services. All of these organizations need help, as does our commitments, moral and contractual, to Israel, as to our commitments to the Soviet Jews who are coming here for help. So that they had to make decisions. I think that the decisions they made were wrong, but I'm not in their shoes. I think.
Why do you think it was wrong?
Because as a result, the Jewish home collapsed. With over $60,000 a month in debt, where was the money to come from? We were already eating into our slim endowment just to maintain the building. And the Jewish community was not prepared to give money. Elderly Jews were not prepared to go there. What could we do? The only resource we had was to struggle on, and then when the union threatened to strike, that caused the collapse of the institution that June of 1993, I think it was, or maybe 94, and you know the rest.
Well, I think it's important that you explained, for those who will be listening to this, the reason for the closing of the home. It's very important. I'd like to move on to you, Dr. Aronson. And as you look back on your very rich, productive career, what makes you the most proud? What accomplishment makes you feel good?
My marriage.
Well, I would agree with that, but we're talking about your professional.
I think some of the research work I had done on brain disease before I came here. Since I've been here, I think the founding of the medical school is something I'm deeply proud of. It seems to be prospering. It's been in business now for 25 years.
How many years were you dean?
10 years. Exactly 10 years. The first 10 years. I'm proud of hospice. I'm particularly proud of a little organization called Interfaith Healthcare Ministries, which Reverend Charles Baldwin and I founded in 1974 as the first interfaith chaplaincy training program in the United States. It's now one of the largest. We've trained hundreds and hundreds of hospital chaplains for countries all over the world, as well as New England.
And this started in Providence?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It started between Charlie Baldwin and myself. And we gradually convinced the Rhode Island Council of Churches to support us. We then convinced the Board of Rabbis to support us, and they continued to support us. We then convinced the Roman Catholic Diocese of Providence, and finally we convinced the medical school to give us money each year, and for 24 years, we've had all of these groups, and we train ministers, priests, nuns, even a rare rabbi, in the problems of sick people who need spiritual help and guidance. And we're the first interfaith ordained chaplaincy school in the United States, and we're regarded as the model for many others. I would say that close to 50% of all chaplains in New England, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, were trained by us. Over 80% in the state of Rhode Island, for the prisons, for the hospitals, for the nursing homes, for the mental health centers. We have given diplomas for close to 500 priests, nuns, ministers, and rabbis who practice in Ireland, Italy, throughout the Pacific, the Philippines, Japan, throughout the United States, South America, etc. It's a great, beautiful organization, now run by the Reverend Dwayne Parker. He's a wonderful person.
You mentioned a couple of weeks ago about the fact that your wife brought you back to Judaism.
Mm-hmm. And kept me there.
Had you lost it?
Had I lost it? No, I was never there. It's not something I lost. I was brought up in a family for a variety of reasons that did not practice Judaism. My father, as a child, went to Cheder, who was trained in Talmudic thinking. But when he came over in 1888 as a six-year-old, as an eight-year-old, he was born in 1880, he was convinced of the importance of assimilation, not to be Jewish, but to be American. And while my older brother, was bar mitzvahed, I was not. I think, in retrospect, much to my profound regret.
How about your mother?
She was not terribly interested in religion. Right? She had...
Your father's influence was stronger than hers?
It wasn't a question of influences, it was a question of will. Do you want something to be undertaken? And in those days, in the days of depression, I came of age at the beginning of the depression. And we had other struggles. My mother was a very, very ill woman throughout the 1930s, barely alive after much surgery and many confrontations with cancer. So her role in decision making was minimal. My father, by not making decisions, made decisions. And so I had no training in Hebrew, no training in any of these aspects of Judaism, classical Judaism.
And yet you were brought up in such a Jewish atmosphere.
I was in a completely Jewish neighborhood. Block after block were occupied only by Jews in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn. And I knew that all of my friends would go, after we finished school in the afternoon, they would go to neighborhood shuls for an hour of Hebrew, and then they would come back and have an hour of violin playing, and I had neither of these, which I think in retrospect is something that I deeply regret. It's a loss which is an irretrievable loss in certain ways. And the first encounter I had with Judaism occurred because of a non-Jew. It was 1942, I was in the army, in the infantry, and came the High Holy Days of 1942, the autumn of 1942. And I was minding my own business. I was a private in the army at that time, and the sergeant of my company, a big, tall fellow by the name of Robinson from Arkansas, came to me and he said he read in his rule books that there's something called a Jew religion. And he found out that there was a High Holy Day, and he said every goddamn, and I won't quote his full sentence, man in his unit is going to be God-fearing, so he expected me to go to my church, as he put it. And I had no idea what he was talking about, but he assigned a jeep and a driver. And they found in the wilderness of the Midwest, we were on the border, on maneuvers on the border of northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin, he found in the town of Beloit, B-E-L-O-I-T, that there was a synagogue. And they sent me in this jeep with the driver, really a guard, make sure I didn't end up in a saloon, I guess, to the synagogue. And I went in, and that's the first time I had ever engaged in services.
And you were how old at that point?
How old was I? 1942. I was 20 years old. 20 years and a fraction. And it's the first time Oh, I had been to one or two bar mitzvahs of relatives when I was a kid, but I had never entered a synagogue before then. And it was a disquieting experience. It lingered when I met my wife some 3 years later, and we got married about 5 years later. We went under the assumption that ours was a Jewish household, but we didn't do anything about it. And it was only in the recent decades, maybe 20 years ago, that my wife felt, not in a ritual sense, but in a spiritual sense, that we needed to know who we were part of, what larger group. And it was she who pointed out to me repeatedly the social values of the tenets of Judaism that had nothing to do with religion, but how one lived and what priorities one accepted, one's agenda in life. And it was my wife, whose background was not Jewish, who was more Jewish than me in many ways, who got us to join the temple.
How about bringing up your children?
They were brought up Jewish, in a vague sort of way. My youngest, Sarah, who's a practicing physician in Connecticut, somewhere while in medical school, she was at Dartmouth. No, actually, even before that.
At Brown. Yeah.
She was an undergraduate at Brown, and she began attending services all by herself, began learning Hebrew all by herself. And at Dartmouth, where there were very few Jews, although the president, interestingly enough, of Dartmouth at that
Dartmouth
time...
Dartmouth was Jewish, yes.
Well, the current president, but the preceding president was also Jewish. A Hungarian refugee, mathematician. Great guy, I got to know him. And Sarah was one of five or six Dartmouth students who every Friday night would conduct services by themselves in the corner of the local Lutheran church. They found an alcove which the church gave them. They had a curtain that they drew, and they had a little ark, a little wooden box with a Torah in it, and they conducted services. And when Sarah graduated medical school, after she finished a year of internship at one of the Yale hospitals, she announced to us that she was going to Israel. And she spent a little over two years in Israel practicing medicine, 1 year at a kibbutz in the south, Holit was its name, Kibbutz Holit, and 1 year way up in the north, literally 10 yards from the Lebanese border. Out of her window, she looked into Lebanon.
It was Misgav Am,
yeah, was the name of it. And in both places she practiced, but she also did chores. She cleaned the kitchens and worked with the cows and whatever people did in rotation at the kibbutz, she did. And Betty and I went there in the autumn of 1979. And it was a great experience for us, because Sarah met us at Ben Gurion Airport. We rented a car, and for 2.5 weeks we saw the things she did, and she took us to every corner except for the Negev and Eilat, every corner of Israel, including the Golan Heights, where we tracked back and forth, the new communities, Jezreel, throughout. And it gave Betty and me an opportunity. I did a little teaching there, at gave some lectures at Hadassah Hospital. And there was the meeting of the Israeli Neurological Society, and I was their guest speaker at a very fancy hotel that reminded me more of Miami Beach than in Israel. All kinds of glitz. What was the name of the city? Herzliya, on the coast. And we went to Technion, where I had friends and where I gave some seminars. So we saw a great deal of the country, and I hope someday to go back. And since then, Betty and I have gone irregularly, but we go to Temple Beth El. We are staunch supporters both of the temple and particularly of its great leader, Les Gutterman. And he's a very, very dear and faithful friend to my family and to my wife and to my children.
You know, I'm sure that you have moments in your life that just, you know, stand out. An event, a moment, an image. Give us a couple of them.
Seeing Israel for the first time from the window of an airplane.
How about putting Sarah?
Oh, yes. Yes. In 1987, my youngest child graduated from the Brown University School of Medicine. And the act, the symbolic act of physicianhood is when somebody, your teacher, the dean typically, places the hood of medicine, which is a velvet hood with the green line, inner lining, which is the color of medicine, around your neck. As soon as that hood is there, you're a physician. You don't have a license yet, but you're a physician in the eyes of the profession. And I had the privilege of putting the hood on around Sarah, and we have, my wife has photographs of it. And it's, I guess, if there were epiphanies in my life, that's one of them.
How about another epiphany?
Oh, let me think. There are some that are too private to share.
In your career?
Well, I'm thinking more important than my career, when one of my children was quite ill.
And you look back, do you have any regrets of something that you didn't do, that you wanted to do, but for one reason or another?
Yeah. My biggest regret in life is that the Jewish home closed. Some of us, and I use the word advisedly, some of us who were younger, had hopes. And we had specific plans that if they could be put in place for that home, to make it a geriatric center. We had already brought in dentists, physicians, who were willing to work closely, ophthalmologists like the great ophthalmologist Jack Skenazy, orthopedic surgeons such as Henry Lichman, internists such as Herb Lichman and Henry Eisman, and scores of others. And we were prepared to turn that center into a place for elder education, for elder care, not only medical and psychiatric, but to change the atmosphere of that home from a warehouse for the dying to a sanctuary for the living. And it collapsed, and we could no longer carry out our hope.
You know, they talk about the mystery of the Jewish existence. What do you think about that? Are the Jews a really mysterious people?
Yeah.
How do you account for their existence?
The first thing I would say is Gott sei Dank. thank God that they exist. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking.
Right.
The three of us. Why? That's a good question. I don't know why, but I'm thankful that there's enough courage and enough tenacity and enough obnoxiousness sometimes to keep us going, when we really should have been wiped out as thousands, as tens of thousands of other small marginal sects or groups had been wiped out. Why we have continued now for approximately 4,000 years is utterly beyond me. The fact that there is genetic evidence now that there is some continuity, and there's some startling new findings, both in this country and in Israel, that indeed the Jews of today are genetically related to the Jews of 2,000, 3,000 years ago. Most
some How people, is that?
Oh, it's a very complex story. but physical anthropologists in Israel, by using certain criteria, can even identify which of the tribes, of the 12 tribes, represent the forebears of the current at least Ashkenazic group of Jews. And it's really from two tribes only, Judah and the tribe of Benjamin particularly. By using the buried remains, certain ratios of bones and this, that, and the other thing, they show the continuity, not with the other tribes, the tribes of Asher and Levi, etc., but principally one tribe, namely the tribe of Benjamin. And there is a little bit of historic evidence that Benjamin, that the tribe of Benjamin, was the tribe that prevailed right into the Roman times. How we survived the Middle Ages and the Crusades is utterly beyond me.
What about World War II?
At least in World War II, there was already a substantial core of Judaism in the United States. And no help from me, unfortunately. But I survived, and now, late in life, I'm becoming a Judaophile, I guess you'd call it. I like things that are Jewish. I identify with things that are Jewish. I spend my time trying to convince some of my liberated co-religionists that they should spend more time looking at their Jewish roots and acknowledging their Jewish roots. And sooner or later, maybe with my wife's help, and maybe prodding, I'll even learn Hebrew. My daughter speaks fluent Hebrew, writes in Hebrew.
How about your other two girls?
They identify themselves as Jewish, but they know nothing about Hebrew. And it's my wife and my youngest child who know Hebrew. And I think within a year or two I'll start learning, and maybe by the age of 85 I may go to speak to Les Gutterman and say, now I'm ready for bar mitzvah.
You know a lot more Yiddish than you realize.
Oh, Yiddish I understand fairly well.
You speak Yiddish?
No, I don't. I can get along with somebody who could speak only Yiddish and no English. But I understand it almost fluently.
What did they call it in Brooklyn when you were growing up? Yinglish?
No. That's a Leo Rostein invention, that word. We call it English.
English.
Nobody said English. It took years in the army for me to get rid of my Yiddish hyphen Brooklyn accent. And to this day, when I talk hard.
You look back on your past. What would you do differently if you had the chance?
By answering that candidly, I don't wish to lessen the joy or the sense of accomplishment that I've experienced having followed the course of actions which I did take after graduation. Much of what Betty and I did was determined by economic needs. We took internships and residencies largely depending upon who paid the highest salary. We had a family to support. We had nobody who could help us in those years. These were in the late 1940s. If I had my way to do it over again, I would have chosen one of two paths. The first path is to go into private practice not in New York City, but in some rural area with my wife, to share the entire spectrum of medical practice, from obstetrics to geriatrics, from psychiatry to pediatrics, and to practice in an anonymous setting. The other possibility, and we came very close to doing this, was that while we were medical students together in our second year of our 4 years at medical school, there was a visiting professor from India, a man by the name of Napier, N-A-P-I-E-R, Sir Henry or Sir William Napier, whatever. And he was a specialist in tropical medicine, and he got us, Betty and me, intrigued with the overwhelming problems of tropical medicine. And we were bound and determined, both of us, to train in tropical medicine after we got our MD degrees. It did not work out because we didn't have the funds even to go to the one city where there was specific training, namely New Orleans. Tulane University was the only medical school that offered postgraduate training in tropical disease, but we didn't even have the car fare to get down to New Orleans, let alone the money to support us. We would have had to pay tuition rather than for an additional degree. So we had to abandon that. That idea came back, though, 5-6 years ago, 1991, when I was approached by the Rockefeller Foundation to oversee some of their educational programs in medical schools in tropical areas, particularly Africa, Asia, South America. And for a few years, Betty and I traipsed all over the world, India, Indonesia, Australia, Africa, South America, all over South America, Chile, Colombia, all over Brazil, looking at the medical schools that the foundation had invested money in. And this was a lot of money, by the way, $17 million a year. And my assignment was to answer to the trustees of the foundation, has their money been invested wisely? So I was given carte blanche, a huge expense account. They would literally put into a bank account at any one time $50,000, and I could draw on it as I saw please, to pay for my travel expenses. Betty's expenses we paid for out of the salary they paid me, in addition to that $50,000. But we really traveled. We saw a great deal, and on many occasions Betty was my co-investigator in interviewing faculty, students, patients even, to see whether the money was used corruptly or creatively. And it brought us back to tropical medicine and the problems, the medical problems of the third world, which is really a general practice kind of problem, where sophisticated tertiary care medicine is absolutely irrelevant, where the principal cause of death in the world today. Florence, let me ask you a question. Name the three leading causes of death in the world. What would your answer be?
Would you say that again?
What are the three leading causes of death in the world today?
Cancer.
Yeah.
Heart.
Disease.
And the third one, I don't know.
Maybe stroke. That's exactly the answer that you'd expect in the United States or Europe. When you look at the world, those three, cancer, heart disease, and stroke, are something like the 30th or the 40th. There are many, many other things. The leading cause of death in the world by far is infantile diarrhea, particularly between the ages of 6 and 18 months. 18 million infants a year die of infantile diarrhea. That's more than all the deaths in the United States from all causes, cancer, etc. The second cause is upper respiratory infection. The third cause will shock you, is measles. Measles is an immense challenge to the medical profession. We've got it solved in this country by a simple vaccine. But to try and vaccinate the children of the world is at the moment a virtually impossible task. So that 3 million a year, 3 million children a year die of measles. This late in life, Betty and I are learning where the priorities of medicine should be. And we're both in our middle 70s now, and we realize that if we had our lives to live over again, this is where we would be. In general practice in this country, or in the practice of community medicine and tropical medicine, whatever you want to call it, overseas somewhere.
You know, the lay people think of doctors. There's still an aura that people have about doctors. Not so much as it used to be, but they still have that feeling about a doctor. They think that many, many doctors make a lot of money, and in many cases, it's true.
It's true.
But in your pursuing your career, was economics ever a factor?
In choosing internships, yes, but in candor, I never... Well, I'll tell you something that will be shocking. It continues to amaze me. The highest salary that Betty ever achieved, plus the highest salary in my entire professional life that I ever had, if you put the two together, was less than what my daughter earned in her first year in private practice some 3 years ago. She earned substantially more than I ever earned in my life as dean, as professor of all kinds of, with fancy titles, as chief of a service at the Miriam Hospital. My income was always through my salary as a teacher, which was, relatively speaking, kind of meager. I have no complaints about it.
Your lifestyle?
I don't think we ever suffered. We have a beautiful farm 20 minutes from here in southern Massachusetts. Our children, all three of them, went to private high schools. They all three went to private colleges, superb institutions, Bard, Smith, Brown, Dartmouth. I mean, these are...
Well, you should have, and I'm sure you do have, a great sense of accomplishment.
No.
You don't?
No, that suggests that... No, accomplishment means to me that if I didn't do it, it would not have been done. You accomplish something... I mean, if the sun rises, you don't accomplish the sunrise. You coexist with it. It's a question of, maybe it's a semantic question, but I don't like the word accomplishment. I was privileged to be part of various organizations, various research studies, to teach. I'm very proud of the fact that there are 19 full professors somewhere in the United States, Mexico, Japan, that I've personally trained in residency training before I came to this community. I'm very proud of roughly a little over 1,000 medical students that I helped to educate at Brown University Medical School. I'm proud of these things, and I think I'm... But I'm still proudest of my marriage.
We're coming to the end of our conversation now. I would like to ask you a final question. When and if young doctors who are about to enter the medical world come to you for advice and counsel, what do you tell them?
Think for yourself. I will want no disciples. I will want colleagues. And colleagues are people who think for themselves, think independently, and take the responsibility for their decisions. Disciples are people who act only in faith and allow other people to make their decisions and assume responsibility for their lives. A physician has to be an independent person, not an employee. He has to take responsibility for what he does. And he has to know what he's doing. And you don't do that by allowing other people to tell you what to do. So I would encourage people to learn, to have insight, to question everything that they do and think. And maybe if they're very lucky, they'll become adults. And maybe if they're very, very lucky, good physicians.
Well, I know that everybody in this community, and I'm sure the entire country, thinks of you as a physician in the very best sense of the word. And we thank you very much for this conversation.